Hey, welcome to part two of Acres of Skin. I was fortunate enough to be put in contact with one of the Holmesburg trials victims' daughter, Miss Adrienne Jones Alston. And I actually recorded this interview a couple of months prior to it airing. And I think that I sat on it a while because, I don't know, we got into a lot of stuff, which is great. It was a lot of good, rich stuff, but I wasn't sure that all of it would be super pertinent to the podcast or pertinent to you, the listener. And some of that stuff was like super heavy and really real. So I got into this ethical debate in my mind, like, should I reserve some of this? What should be released versus what should be reserved? And I did have to redact some names for privacy, but in the end, I came to the conclusion that it's not really my call. This isn't my story. And this story was shared with me for the purpose of this podcast. I am simply the shepherd of it. So here it is. All right. Thanks so much for joining me today. So I gave you a little bit of background, but the audience is already somewhat familiar with you and your story and your father's story. But, you know, before I guess we get into talking about the Holmesburg trials in the prison, I really wanted to talk a little bit about who your father really was at his core as a dad. Can you give me a little bit of, you know, your experience growing up with your dad? I feel like the last time we talked, or a couple of times before we last talked, you mentioned some really cool stuff about his community activism and actually, getting to meet like Tupac's mom.
Yes.
Yeah,
it was cool. If you, in the beginning, you know, like I said, I was like four or five years old when he started, but I remember my orientation of it. My mother came and got me one day. She came to me and said, your father on TV. I said, he on TV? And I got my little chair. I had this little brown wooden chair. I used to sit in and watch TV. So I sat down in the chair. And I forget who that, I don't know, Ed Sullivan, back in that day, somebody like that was interviewing him. He was sitting there. And I remember starting kindergarten. I told them, my dad is famous.
That's fame. But,
yeah, and he started that activism inside of prison, you know. Okay. I guess by him being there and seeing what happened and having a passion for helping people, you know, he had a big heart. It was kind of cool. I'm telling you, there's no way I could go in North Philly in my neighborhood that they didn't know. That's the oldest daughter right there. That's like your father. I couldn't go nowhere. When I became a teenager and wanted to sneak in the bars and the motorcycle clubs and stuff, they went,
Nah.
Until I got older and I got away with it. But
It was cool
being his daughter, you know, and watching him grow. You know, it was kind of strain on our relationship when my mother and father finally separated, because she was one of them, you ain't seeing the kids, you know, and we went through that, you know. So I had to sneak around on the phone, you know, as a preteen and do all that stuff. So.
No, I could totally relate to that. I look identical to my father, too, and can't get away with anything. They call me Face. My nickname is Face. That's it.
Because of him.
Basically, yeah. Totally identify with that.
Oh, wow.
And he's a minister too, so got away with nothing. So will you talk about, you know, your dad's activism post his incarceration? Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what landed him in prison? How long was he there?
Daddy received a receiving stolen property charge at one time. You know, that wasn't his only time. At that time that he specifies, you know, in the Acres of Skin and other times, he received a receiving stolen property. He did a little bit of time you know, but while he was there, all that went down. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he, my dad was fast. He was in the streets, you know, before he straightened his life out and got down with what he needed to do with his activism and got real serious about it. He was one of them young hard-head ones, you know. He was in a gang war, the Tenderloins, who he later, oh gosh, as he became an activist, he organized their gang wars. No, he didn't organize them. What he did was he caused the gangs to make a truce. And as they began to mature in life and age and grow, they became friends. And they started having events. So my father would sponsor probably annually cabarets. You know, I have literature here where the Tenderloins came together and the other groups, it was North Street and Montgomery Avenue, you know, the Valley, that was their name. But that was, when I sat back and took in the fullness of what he actually did, they would be in the street playing double dutch. And one guy would go up the top of the block and we'd see him, they say, gang war. And they start running down the street with rifles and stuff in their hand. We had to duck under cars and stuff. And one time I couldn't get under there fast enough, I start running. I ran to the end of the block away from my house because they was in front of the house where they were running. So I was trying to get away. When I got to that corner, who was around that corner but my father in the middle of the street telling them, hold it, him and my Uncle Reggie. Whatever they were saying, they had their hands up and they was telling the guys, y'all not going to do this. Y'all not going to kill each other. It's enough. And they preached. Those guys was me, a little girl, scared, peeping from under a car, watching them stand there and listen to my father and my uncle talk to them, and they did not fight. I will never forget that the rest of my life. Never. I wonder if they still have the cabaret since Daddy passed away. I gotta look into that because I would like to show up to one. They got, girl, they got sharp. They put on the hats, the suits, the shoes, and he would call my brother and say, I done raised the bar now on the attire, and he'd be like, we're gonna do this, and they would get tux, and I mean, they went in. I was in Virginia, I never went to one. You know, I stayed away, but once I got out of Philly, I went through so much, I didn't put forth a lot of effort to come back. But I got all the news, but yeah, they went all out for them cabarets. And I'm proud of him about that too. That was a big accomplishment, yeah, you know, to bring those gangs to a truce. So that was another thing that he a great accomplishment of his.
Yeah, no, that story is really powerful. And, you know, as you tell it, I can kind of see in your eyes, you like replaying it and moving through it.
Yeah.
And it's powerful because, you know, this is a part of your lived experience as a kid. And I really want to get into how, you know, how this has affected your development and your perspective. But also it's really impactful because, you know, had your dad not gone through these things, had he not, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate, but joined a gang, gone to Holmesburg, like he wouldn't have been able to intercede in this way on behalf of other people, you know? Yeah. So when we talk about, you know, how this has or might have impacted you and your family, even generationally, there's so much I could say about, you know, prison reform in general, but this is like, I'm trying to stay on topic and stick to clinical research, but I mean,
I know, because it's just so many memories going through my mind right now where
I know it is. I can see it.
Give you what you need. Oh my goodness.
I'll take whatever, but you know, I also don't want to be, you know, I don't want to keep you here for 2 hours, but you know, how did you see this kind of impact you growing up and even impact perhaps like your children?
Well, I'm going to tell you one thing. It made me very alert and aware. It made me alert and aware about my surroundings and people. You know what I'm saying? In general, still today. I was taught a lot in that movement. I was raised But I have my father's DNA and my uncle's DNA. My mother's brother, her brother was a Black Panther captain in North Philly. So we was in all those events. So as a young girl, I was molded between those two men. And they taught us some stuff. You know what I'm saying? So It made me very alert and aware. My children, I taught them the same way. You know, I had my brushes with the law. I went to prison, but I always taught them to be alert and aware of people. I'm talking about people, period. Always, you know, keep a lot of people out of your house, stay out of trouble, watch your children, mind your business. You know what I'm saying? They made me very alert. Don't too much get past me.
I bet not.
I'm telling you, don't too much get past me. My father was very watchful. And he analyzed you down to the T. I couldn't even stand in front of his face and tell a lie because he'd be like, I don't want to hear that shit, you know? But yeah,
it's all right.
I've taught my children that. And the clinical part of his life, when he went through the experiments, how that impacted me, the emotional trauma, it rings out, I mean, every day. It is not a week that goes by that I don't replay what went on in our home when my father was going through that the chemical that I'm going to say psychosis. That was in his he went through something, and I didn't even realize it until I was approached by Penn. After I was approached by Penn, because when the Penn professor did, we had the same thing, the podcast production he was trying to put together. And he said, what was it like being Leotis Jones? So I was like, oh, it was fun. Not that I did this. But let me tell you something, a day or two later, reality set in. I'm like, whoa, he talking about the damages, and I didn't even internalize the clinical part. When I started internalizing that, I started connecting dots, and I got proactive, because now we got an issue. Because some things is adding up now with daddy, me, my children. It's still affecting my life. My children are scarred by my youth because I was so freaking damaged. I was a damaged girl, young lady, and woman. I'm still trying to put my pieces together. And I'm dealing with my children, but my old stuff is coming out in them. They still have resentments. You know, we having a little family battle now about some stuff. To me, it's minor. Y'all better let that stuff go because I'm going forward. I'm not perfect. Neither are you. Life is too short. Whatever we can get through, let's let the professionals work on it. You need a counselor, let's go sit down. Mm-hmm. But you have to get through this life. You have to be as healthy as you can be to get through this. So my father's Holmesburg experiment, I'm going to say presentation to our family, it's still affecting us. Now I have grandchildren who are watching my daughter who's damaged because of me and me because of my father. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. And, you know.
It's real deep. It's real. It's real.
It is real deep. And it's you said so much that I want to get at. And, you know, we'll touch on a few of those things later on. But it is really deep. And there, to be clinical, there's all these, like, studies now about, you know, how stress and all, you know, how oppression can leave an imprint on your genome, on your genetic code, and be passed down to the next generation. And, you know, you can read about it in these, like, you know, clinical journals, or you can talk to people and just, you can see it. So
I live it.
or you can live it. Or I mean, we all, everybody lives a degree of it, but man, like, this is, I wanted to know too, you know, did your dad ever, like, share with you directly his experiences? Like, what really, what happened to him? I've read about it, but, you know, in the spirit of, like, actually hearing from someone directly, like, did he talk to you about his experience and how he felt and what happened to him?
Not a lot, because what I'm going to assume happened, because my father was a very prideful man, that after he realized what happened, then he became ashamed of what he had caused to happen in his life. You know what I'm saying? What happened to him? Because his back was scarred. You know, his back from the, I told y'all, from the top of the back of his neck down to the back of his thighs was just marred. You know, he was embarrassed.
Yeah.
He was embarrassed that my father's mom was like, I just played myself. You know, he said, them cats just played me. And then he felt used and he got angry and he didn't want to talk to us about it. He talked about it was battle time. It was about them courtrooms. It was about those rallies and protests. Mm-hmm. For him to sit down and just have a casual family conversation, that didn't happen about them scars and what happened, you know? Because he, I think, the man that he is, he always wanted to seem strong to me. You know what I'm saying? I saw the strong side. And that's what he wanted me to see. But I understand now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I wish he had cried on my shoulder, you know? He held all that stuff in, but he held a lot of stuff in. That's what, you know? I'm understanding a whole lot more today. Mm-hmm. I am.
And, I mean, that really gets it. It's so much more than, you know, a clinical issue or physical scars. In a lot of ways, when this story in particular, but in general, if research is done in a way that's unethical, it strips away at people's dignity.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes, you know, a psychological scar. And especially for, you know, in our community, especially for Black men, you know, like, I don't want to, not trying to characterize or typecast, you know, but when I think about my dad and the, you know, the older Black men in my life, like they want to be strong for your family and for their family. They're not going to, especially if they think something's their fault or that they didn't catch something, like they're not going to burden you with any of that. So I absolutely get that. I guess then from your perspective, when your dad was released, what change did you see in him?
He was a little more reserved, and he was always to me thinking, because he was quiet, you know. He went from quiet to argumentative, and he had this little voice. He never raised his voice, but he would just start talking to my mother, and it'll always be like a issue he had. And I'm a kid, and I can say, I looked at him like, are you serious? It was petty stuff. But that was their hostility. So when an argument started, I started moving, because I know what was coming next. You know what I'm saying? I had two siblings. My brother was older, but he was a little, I was the aggressor. So I always thought I was the oldest. And my sister, she was around too. She's 2 years under me. But he would go from a quiet day in the morning to be quiet, and he didn't go to work no more. He was home with a robe on. Sometimes he was looking rough. But he would go from talking to my mom about some old stuff, and then an argument would start. And then let me tell you what I would do. I would get up, I'd grab my brother, my sister, she was the littlest, and Greg used to follow us, and I'd put them behind the couch. I started paying attention, so when a fight broke out, they would be out the way. I went in the bathroom, and I would take my hair out, put Vaseline on my grease on my face, take all my clothes off down to a pair of panties, and when they started fighting, I jumped in it. I was sliding, and they were sweating, and when I talked to my mom about it, we talked about it recently. She said, is that what you was doing up there? I said, I was trying to stop y'all, but I was swinging too. Cause she said, well, why was you swinging? I said, because y'all was swinging. You know what I'm saying? And I see the street fighters in Philly. They grease their face and, you know what I'm saying? Put their sneakers on, and my clothes always get tall. So I just took my clothes off. I own a pair of drawers and all my hair everywhere. And I was fighting with two adults. My dad was sick. This happened frequently. My mother went through so much. You know, went through a lot.
How old were you?
I was around five then. I said around four or five. I was young. But my mother said, I can't believe you still remember that. I said, Mom, you know, I was nosy. I was very inquisitive child. I told you, did nothing slip past me. I was like a house detective. You know, I knew everybody moves and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I was the protector of my siblings, you know.
Yeah.
So when my grandma passed away, this was before my father passed away, he came to my grandmother's house and we all were sitting on my grandma's porch over there on 33rd and Huntington. And I looked at the both of them and I said, y'all always ask me what was wrong. And that's the first time I repeated that. I said, you know, but y'all ran me crazy. And they started laughing, but I was serious. You know, because even after they broke up, my mother was like, are you talking to him on the phone? Don't be calling him on my phone. Then my dad, well, you know your mom crazy. You know, they did that back and forth. You know, if I was talking to my dad on the phone and my mom came in, she was talking, he'd get mad. Well, I'll talk to you later. Like, they played with my head so bad, you know. Mm-hmm. I grew up fast.
Yeah.
I grew up fast, you know.
Yeah, and that's such a combination of so much stuff.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. It's a combination of a lot. Again, I wish that I had the opportunity or the time or even the expertise. I don't. If I had a friend of mine who's really into prison reform on this call, she could really get into a lot of this. But it just goes to show. It's one thing when you take, you know, the black man out of the household. Right. And they're in prison and there's this whole system, you know, that kind of just breaks apart our family structure. But to return them back to the family structure, broken, not just by the system, but additionally by
chemical psychosis, like drug induced psychosis.
And that have affected, like, it's impossible. You make it impossible for families to restructure, to heal.
My family was destroyed. My dad was shot up with all those concoctions in prison. They did what they wanted to do. You know, when he came home sick, wreaking havoc. He argued with people in the neighborhood too. He always had something going on. You know what I'm saying? And he was not the only man or woman who did that. You had a whole lot of monsters that come out of there, out of prison, and went home and terrorized their families because they got all that mess in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a book. My dad had a binder put together, and it has all 300 names of the people who were experimenting on at Holmesburg. It's just names. And I tried to, I'm like, I can't go through all this stuff. I got so much going on. But I'm pretty sure some of them are still around. They say a lot of them are gone, you know. I'm waiting for the opportunity to talk to Youssef Anthony. I'm going to get him. I'm this close.
I heard he went underground. I tried.
I'm going in his house and sit on his couch. We going to talk.
Yeah, yeah, yes. He should be open.
I'm getting there.
To you. Yeah.
I'm getting there.
I mean, but I get it. You know, I watched interviews with Youssef, you know, I think at like Stanford, you know, telling his story. And it probably like I just mentioned to you, like when you retell a story, in a lot of ways you relive it. You just do. Mm-hmm. And you can see it on people's faces. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching the interview of him at Stanford. And I was like, this man's tired. I remember thinking that to myself. I was taking notes for the first episode. And I was like, man, this guy's like, he's tired of what he's been through, but he's also probably tired of telling his story. But talking to you is different. Like, I'm sure you guys
tired. He had a lot of exposure. You know, he did a lot of things. A lot of people was paying him to tell the story. I mean, he kind of burnt himself out. So he runs from
redacted.
I know I'm recorded, but he ran from
him. No. I got that sense. It's so funny you say that because I got that sense. Well, I'll cut this part out. But yeah, I mean, if you get in contact with him, I would love to talk to him, but I also know that he has done so much and he's done plenty for these people.
I want him to do one thing for me. And I understand that he recently had a stroke. So he's mobile, he's using a cane now, so his health is not real good right now. I just want him to do one thing for me. I want the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation with him, and I want to report it. I just want us to sit down and talk, because we family. I'm gonna tell you, you know, you did the same thing. Y'all went through, he had different ailments than my dad, but hey, this is not something that just happened. Here I am, my dad's gone and I'm here. This is not a mistake. This was not in my plans. It was not, but I feel compelled and I can't stop. I'm doing it, you know, I'm praying. I'm a firm believer in God, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm here.
Yeah. And when look, I think we all have, you know, a calling and a divine purpose. And when you talk about, you know, you feeling kind of called and drawn to this, when you think about, you know, honoring your dad's legacy, I know we kind of talked a little bit, you said you were going to start a nonprofit and, you know, what are some of the things you think that you or that you're already doing or that you want to do, and how can people participate? How can I help? How can anybody help?
I want to be a voice for returning citizens, and I really want to be a bigger voice for people who suffer with mental health issues, you know, and coming out of the system and not treated. That's a biggie. Because, first of all, when you're in there, you got to look at, why the hell am I here? Or why do I keep coming back? What is wrong with me? Something, mental health treatment is vital if you have a repetitive behavior or something. You know, you have to identify that thing in order to know what you're dealing with. You got to identify it. Why do I keep using drugs? Why do I keep doing this? You know, you can't keep giving pieces of your life to the system, because they don't care. They don't give you three hots in the cot every time. But what are you getting? You know? People, I don't know how that mental health piece is going to come. All I can do is share my story and help it and, you know, help somebody else. So that's my plan. You know, I'm going to use this platform, and I'm going to call my ex platform where I stood right there and I was talking and cursing on that video up there at the march. I'm going to use that platform and I'm going to build from that. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to make myself a better speaker. I'm going to always tell the truth. You know, I'm going to always deliver a message that I think will help someone else from stop being a recidivist, you know? Deal with your issues. I set up my webpage and I started blogging a little bit, and I don't know, I'm just playing with it. The website is not what I wanted to be. I'm gonna get somebody to work with me to build it up to where it need to be, but I want to talk about stuff and I want to blog some things, you know, that them issues. I want to talk about all that stuff. Yeah. So when somebody turning them pages or looking at that website, because I do communicate with probation officers, because I'm helping people up in Newport News right now, get housing, transitional housing. So I'm connected with a woman who's opened up actually her second house. And I have to call her because the probation officers will call me. But I got my plate got full. I referred them straight to her. But I'm going to dip back in there because I need that with them. You know, I built a rapport with them, but I have to be connected with them in order to talk to my people. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, yeah. I really, really do. And I will want your blog and like the website, because I want to post it under this episode so people can check it out.
No, not yet. I got to work on it.
Okay, whatever. Look.
I'm going to give it to you so yes, you can please. See it now.
Okay. Yeah. But so I'll post it whenever you're ready. Whenever you're ready, I'd like to get it out to public. But see, that's the thing too. Like even with this podcast, I was like, it's not ready. I'm not ready. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm sure I've stumbled a lot and talked. You know what I mean? You're like you said, you're telling your story. You're being honest. You're being truthful, and you're connecting with your community, and that's what matters. It'll it'll build and sharpen as you go. But okay, I have a couple more questions, and I know we're like running on time. I do not want to keep you too long. Okay, so we talked a little bit about like honoring your father's legacy, But when I think about, you know, justice for what's been done and justice for those who are still surviving and the children of survivors, what do you think that looks like?
Now?
What do you think, what do you think people should do now? What do you think justice will look like for Yusef, for yourself?
I would really, Yusef right now, justice for him is getting medical support because that's what he needs. He's never, even with all the court hearings and stuff, he's never been compensated. He's, you know what I'm saying? Nobody ever helped that man and he is suffering a lot. Justice for me and others will be Penn meeting that petition and doing what they have to do to help people to recover. It's not just our families. The city of Philadelphia needs to recover from these decades of lies and deceit. You understand what I'm saying? That Penn supported a whole lot of things. It's not just that. I've been doing some research on them. They're working with some stuff. So they're going to have to let some of them babies, they hold, they're going to have to let some of that stuff out. Let me tell you something. I would like to sit down and talk to Amy Gluckman because this is not a game. I am not here saying, give me the money. This is bigger than money. This is countless lives. My father died a sick man. He was still sick from that stuff. Yusef is on his last leg. Lord, I'm not trying to call his number, but you understand what I'm saying? He's up in age. A lot of people died through the process. This is not a game. Your white supremacists and whoever else played a part in that back in the day, hiding them lies. We ain't going to give them nothing. We ain't going to do nothing for them. Why not? I need my stock out of that night because my daddy's skin is in them jars. You understand what I'm saying? Literally. Mm-hmm. Thousands and millions of people is using that stuff every day. And when I look at that stuff, I bought 3 boxes. I bought 4 boxes. Of that stuff with Retin A in it's downstairs in my garage and I got it on the shelf and I'm gonna leave it there. And I got it, one for my daughter, one for my granddaughter. When my mother come, I'm gonna give her hers and I have one and I'm telling them, don't never open it. You remember that. My daddy's skin is in that jar.
Man.
Yeah, justice for me is them doing the right thing. Look at Henrietta Lex. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to curse, but what kind of stuff is that?
Yeah, they but
they just do what they want and lie and will protect each other with that mess. Justice is saying, hey, we have to stop. We got to make this right.
Yeah,
I'm not going away. My children are going away. Now my grandchildren are paying attention. We're not going to stop coming for them.
Yeah. And you shouldn't, and you shouldn't. I think it's very important for people to take accountability. So I told you I work in clinical research and I've worked in clinical research most of my life. And I've been trying to improve diversity in clinical research because it is important for Black and Brown people to be represented in clinical trials because if we're not, then, you know, drugs aren't made for us. If, you know what I mean? Like, essentially that. If we're not a part of it, then the drugs are not going to be tailored for us. Mm-hmm. But in some of the work that I've done, obviously, we run into issues of medical mistrust. People don't want to join research. They don't want to join clinical trials. My grandma told me this crazy story about Johns Hopkins, like this children's scary story they had about Johns Hopkins, like putting kids, like they would threaten you, like we'll put you outside on the street, you know, and then the Johns Hopkins researchers will come get you. Like there is a deep-seated fear, justifiably, in medicine, but then also in research. So my biggest thing that I've been harping on that it's hard, it seems very simple, but it's a really hard thing to drive home is be transparent as, you know, a pharmaceutical company or a hospital and take accountability. If you are unable to take accountability for something that happened 60 years ago, that mm-hmm. is not hearsay,
you
that
didn't
is
have nothing
fact,
to do with it.
Right. You're not, your name isn't in the history books. If you can't take accountability for that, why should the community trust you now?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know. What do you think? do you think that we'll ever get to a place? And I'm hoping that that's also the point of this podcast. The podcast is entertainment because I like true crime, but it's also to get stories out and to talk about how, you know, there have been a lot of things that have been put in place after, you know, the 60s, 70s that prevent a lot of this from happening again. So we mm-hmm. should, and we should be able to participate in clinical trials. But mm-hmm. do you think that we'll ever get to that point? And do you think we'll get to a point where there will be trust in at least our community, the Black community, in research? And what would it take for us mm-hmm. to get there?
I don't think that's going to ever happen, because as long as we have this racism, you know, and injustices within the penal system, it's going to be very hard to build trust. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't see that happening. I see us coming to a place where I am with Penn. I'm hoping to at least dialogue about this. And I say that because of what recently happened with MOVE, what happened with the health administrator or Department of Health administrator or somebody who stepped, he resigned because of the part that he played with the cremation of the bodies. Those are two major things. And then you pay attention to some of the organizations that are giving reparations to descendants of slaves in other states. And you know, it's just a lot going on. People are starting to pay attention and wake up, you know, and give back the ones that feel convicted. A pen is a little deeper seated. It's a really deeper seated, dark light type thing. And I believe that a bulk of their things is white supremacy. But it's like they have a spiritual, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying.
I do. I actually really understand what you're saying.
It's just
you can feel it. You can sense that.
It's just something deeper with them. That's why I got to go to God when I deal with that stuff. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Keep me covered.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, definitely be... You seem to be very vigilant in the work that you're doing. I would love to help out in any way that I can. Is there anything that's coming up that, you know, people who listen to this podcast, which is mostly just like my friends and family, but is there anything that we can do to support the work that you're doing or to support just this effort?
Well, I can't answer that right now. What I would need to support is, because it's me right now.
Yeah.
And I'm just beginning to build. I'm not just me, because I have supporters. I am surprised of the outpouring of support from the people from Penn.
Good. That's lovely.
The students and the professors. You know what I'm saying? But I have others who have read my newspaper articles. Have you seen those yet?
Mm-hmm.
Who have read my articles, and I got emails, you know, so I communicate, and I'm building a nice little family, a nice little network for myself, you know, a family of people that are supportive, and that's important to me. So I don't know what to say that people can do to help me, because okay. I still have an attitude of servitude.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes,
so
ma'am.
I have to get there, but Nicole, I'm going to keep that in mind, and when we talk again, I'm going to be able to answer that.
All right. Well, you have my contact information. Let me know anytime you're in Chicago, if you're doing anything. Oh. Yeah.
I know one. Go on my webpage. It's looking like my webpage. Oh, and if you can, looking like in memory of Leotis Jones. It's a Facebook page. I set that up, and I put a lot of different things that come up in the news, a lot of things with prison reform, everything that's updated with Penn, all that. So if y'all can get on there and help me.
Just follow it, keep current.
I need more followers. So
Got
I'm
it.
Just starting this stuff. I need more followers on Daddy's page, and I need a little more traffic on mine. I need a lot more traffic, because It's just like everything was just dropped in my lap. I'm all right with it because this is my stuff. Mm-hmm. But my sister, I have a sister in Philly. She said, I don't want nothing to do with it. They're going to kill you.
See? Yeah, that mistrust.
I said, let me tell you something. Daddy walked decades. And she said, well, nobody going to mess with him as mean as he was. I said, well, look at how him and Uncle Reggie fought for years about what they believed in. And maybe you don't have the passion I have because you haven't been through what I've been through. So maybe this is just for me. Mm-hmm. You know?
That's right.
Because I can't identify with a whole lot of stuff. In the system, out of the system. What my daddy went through. With all this discrimination, all that stuff. My God sees everything.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there'll be so much opportunity for us in the future to work together again. I would love... to talk again, just more specifically about the prison system and prison reform, and maybe bring mm-hmm. some of my folks on who know much more about that than I do. But again, you have my cell phone, you have my email, like anything that I can do to help out, to help the cause, any petitions you want to send my way.
Okay, I'm going to send you the Facebook page for my father. I'm going to send you my website information. And have you ever talked with Meek Mill?
No, ma'am. No, Meek Mill.
Meek Mills, the rapper. Meek Mills was just in the news here in Virginia with the governor on prison reform.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to reach out to him. He's doing a lot. I hear that. And I'm dreaming big. I'm going to reach out to him and a couple other people that are up in the industry that's doing things, especially the ones that's from Philly. Because y'all already know. Y'all better act like y'all know. Because I'm going to put them on blast. When I get my platform built, I'm going to be like, Meek, you wrong. So-and-so, you wrong. Y'all get up there and talk that good shit. You better get it together.
And be about it. Get it together. That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This was great.
I enjoyed this conversation like this. Thanks, Nicole. I look forward to it real soon, okay?
Okay. Hey, that is it for Acres of Skin. If you would like to connect with Adrienne, I'll link her website in the episode notes. In upcoming episodes, so we're going to hear from clinical research professionals to discuss the improvements that have been made upon the ethics and the conduct of research, because, you know, while these stories are really important to tell, it's also and equally important to hear how far we've come. Until next time, I'm your host, Nicole Fisher, and thanks for listening to Clinical Mistrials.